Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Heretics Hour on this November 3rd, 2014. I'm Carolyn Yeager, your host. Well, I received some donations this week, so I want to thank Dimitar, Richard, and Jaime for their kind contributions. And I am still on the controversial subject of the Slavs, and in particular now the Poles and the Germans. Last week, I said that Polish history is, in large part, an invention, especially the first 500 years, and tonight I will have more to say about that. I'd like to recommend one of my better research articles from 2011 that appeared in TBR, or the Barnes Review, at the time, and can be found at carolynyager.net, titled The Search for World War II Mass Graves. It was given a different title in the Barnes Review, but it begins with a letter to a German-American newspaper by Dr. Ottwald Müller, in which he comments on the September 1st, 2009 conference held in Gdansk, Poland, what previously was Danzig, to mark the 70th anniversary of the beginning of what was to become World War II. Certainly, the participants of that Polish-German war had no idea they were beginning a world war. Well, in any case, this article opens with the Polish version of Polish deaths from this war standing at 6 million, and that's what they were commemorating and remembering in their conference in 2009. And Dr. Müller shows us that this is double what actually were the Polish losses, and that they were counted twice, basically. And he uses population reports and gives us a lesson in history in the whole thing. It turns out to be a pretty long letter, and it's all there in that article. That letter was discovered by Wilhelm Christman, who read those newspapers, those German-American newspapers at the time, and saw it in there. Now, this article is not too hard to find because it's currently number 5 on the list of my most popular articles on the front page at carolynyager.net. So, you know, you can just go there and click on it when you see it, rather than I give you the URL. But however you find it, I would recommend you at least go and read this first part of it by Dr. Müller. Then it goes into a lot of other stuff after that. And the title is The Search for World War II Mass Graves. So now I'm going to turn first to modern Poland before I go into the history, the deeper history than I went last week, or at least in more detail. Most of this is from the Wikipedia page titled just Poland, and it's under the heading, under the section of demographics. And some of this might be from 2002, but some of it said it was 2013, but it switches around. And I read something from 2002 in the way of some of these statistics. But in any case, this is basically the way it is now. And starting out with the land mass, I want to point out that the current borders of Germany give it 357 square kilometers of land, or 137.8 square miles. And that compares to Poland, which is slightly smaller, at 312.7 square kilometers, or 120.7 square miles. I used to look at the map and think that Poland was bigger than Germany, but it's not actually, because Germany's longer. But they're very close now. However, Germany's population is 80.2 million, while Poland has a population of only 38.5 million. So less than half of the population of Germany. In fact, it comes to 48% of the population of Germany, and yet they are almost as large in size. Going on with this, to establish it in your thinking, Poland has the eighth largest population in Europe, while Germany has the second largest population in Germany. It comes right after Russia. If you don't include Russia, that it's the most populous nation in Europe. Germany is the most populous country in the European Union, and it has a population density of 225 inhabitants per square kilometer, while Poland is the sixth most populous country in the European Union with a density of only 122 inhabitants per square kilometer. 225 versus 122. And so Germany is almost twice as crowded as Poland. Now what I'm getting at here, if it's not obvious to you, to my listeners, is why so much land was taken from Germany after World War II and given to Poland. I mean, you know, if you just look at it from the sense of who needs the land, the Poles don't need it, but the Germans do. And that's been the case all along, but I'm not even going to bother trying to answer that question because we know the answer. So that should be clear to you. If it isn't, you'll have to write to me and ask me to explain it. And what makes it even worse, much worse, is that since Poland's accession to the European Union, a significant number of Poles have emigrated primarily to the United Kingdom, Germany, and the Republic of Ireland, in search of better work opportunities abroad. So even though Poland got all that land, the Poles that are there are even leaving and going where? Not first to Germany, but one of the three they primarily go to is Germany, who they took land from. But they're going to go there because there's more opportunity for them there than there is in their own country. And, of course, we know that they go a lot to the United Kingdom and then quite a bit to Ireland. It says that in 2007, April, the Polish population of the United Kingdom had risen to approximately 300,000. I think that's too low. And the estimates place the Polish population in Ireland at 65,000. But some sources claim that, and it doesn't give who these sources are, but some sources claim that the number of Polish citizens who emigrated to the UK after 2004 is as high as 2 million. That is very possible, but the people in the UK would have to say so. They might be covering up a little bit. The source of that is a newspaper article in a British newspaper. I forget which one. Okay, it says the title of it was UK lets in more Poles than there are in Warsaw. That was the title of it. This, however, is contrasted by a recent trend that shows that more Poles are entering the country than leaving it. Well, so what? You know, so they want this, you know, all these pages about Poland on Wikipedia. As I said last week, and it's the truth for everybody, the people who have the greatest interest in it are the ones who work on these pages and get them the way they want and pay attention to them. So this page is going to look out for Polish interests. Not just this page, but there's a lot of others, and I'm quoting from a number of them tonight. So there's a lot of pages about Poland and Polish history in different ways it's put together, and the Poles are very, very good, or I might say very active when it comes to presenting the image of their country and of their people, and they really do a job with that. They're not lazy about that, and they're all working on it, or at least I think a whole lot of them do. They present it in the best light that they can. And this statement that a recent trend shows that more Poles are entering the country than leaving it, think about that. If for years there were more leaving and not hardly any entering, now some of them are coming back, but they're still leaving. They're just not leaving in as great a numbers as they were, and the entry and leaving is a little bit more even. That doesn't really fix the problem. Polish minorities, I got here, are still present in the neighboring countries of Ukraine, Belarus, and Lithuania, as well as in other countries. And, you know, these three nationalities are the three that the Poles were, as I believe I read that last week, the Poles were so harshly persecuting in their own Second Polish Republic between the two wars that they were so persecuting the people in these countries, the Ukrainians, the Belarusians, that was the White Russians, and the Lithuanians, as well as the Germans, who aren't mentioned here. And yet they're residing in these countries. If they dislike these people and their ways and customs and so on so much, and their language, why don't they just go back to their own country? The reason is they can't live as well in Poland. There's not enough work opportunities, and when they do have them, they don't pay as well. And some of these probably do pay better, or they wouldn't be there. So they take advantage of everything that they can, and altogether, the number of ethnic Poles living abroad is estimated to be around 20 million. If those 20 million were to go back to Poland, Poland, instead of having a population of, I really don't know if Poland's population, does it include the people who have gone elsewhere in the European Union, but only temporarily on work visas and so on? They're not citizens of those other countries. They don't become citizens always of the United Kingdom or Germany, but they're there working. So they would still be included in the Polish population figures, I'm sure. If you add 20 million to the 38 million that are here, you'd have 58 million, but maybe they're already included, a lot of them, already included in that number. Then it also says that the largest number of Poles outside of Poland can be found in the United States, naturally. We know that. And the number, the figure for that that's given is 10 million, approximately 10 million Polish Americans in the United States. That's 3.2% of the population of the U.S. The Polish Americans are the largest European ethnic group of Slavic origin in the United States. And the they're the biggest emigrators of all. And the second, and that's, I guess that would include Russians too, which is kind of hard to believe. But, the second largest Central and Eastern European group, the Poles are, and the eighth largest immigrant group overall. So I'd have to put that in a place there, which I haven't done. But I want to move on. I don't want to bore you to death with statistics. So I will say that I've also learned that Poles are not even producing children the way they used to. They're like all the rest of the Europeans. The total fertility rate in Poland was estimated in 2013 at 1.32 children born to a woman who is capable of bearing children, I guess. 1.32 children. And that's below the replacement rate of 2.1. And actually, Germany is doing slightly better than that. But that's probably because of the Turks in Germany, not because of the Germans. Just to repeat, as I said last week even, but now I have more to back it up, the Poles wanted as much territory as they could get, and now they won't even live in it, and they want to go and live somewhere else because their country's too poor. Well, if Germany hadn't lost as much territory as it did, they would have that part of that part prosperous too, and the Poles would have even more opportunities to make money. So the Poles, as we're going to find, are always cutting off their nose to spite somebody else, and they're always hurting themselves by their foolish ambitions and desires and hungers for more and more and more. You know, I'm just going to put in right here, tell me, as I've asked before, about other groups, what is there to admire about Poland and Poles? Really? And nobody, when I ask that question, the Poles who I ask it of don't ever answer me. For many, what people defend about Poles is that they're white. Well, they're white, you know. That's enough for them. Poles are white. Well, certainly they're not excluded from the white race, and they're not excluded from anything. They're part of Europe, but what is there really to admire? So before I go on to a few more things related to that, I'm going to tell you a story, or I'm going to bring up a news item that appeared just today in the news that I was reading, and I thought, well, it fits in here pretty well. And the title of it was, Poland Says It Will Beef Up Military on Eastern Border. Now, we know, if you've been paying attention, you know that Poland is worried about being treated by Russia the way Ukraine is being treated. And they've been saying that quite a while now. And they've been calling on NATO to come in their country and put up defenses and so on. So they are wanting to get help from Europe. They're, of course, a member of the European Union and have been since 2004, I think. They're, as usual, looking for help. And they said, this article starts out, Holland said on Tuesday it is drawing up a long-term plan to shift some of its military strength towards its eastern border, closer to Ukraine and Russia, in response to Russia's intervention in Ukraine. Well, this is a long-term plan is really long-term. They don't plan to have anything even beginning until 2017. But they're announcing it here because I think that they realize that since they're not getting the answer from NATO and the other, their allies, their NATO allies that they want, they realize that they have to show some proactive, take some proactive measures on their own to do something to defend themselves. And so that's what this is all about. At least that's my thought about it. And I will certainly be watching and paying attention, as I just generally do, to see what more comes from this. But I want to go ahead and quote from this article. And Polish Defense Minister Tomasz Simoniak said, quote, "We want to strengthen our units in the east of Poland. It's a plan that will be spread out over a number of years. The first effects will be seen in 2017. You know, when I read that, I thought, what? You know, it's not even 2015 yet. And the first effects won't be seen until 2000. And this is ongoing, this war business and all this threat and so on that they're so worried about. And they seem to be taking their time quite a bit. But he goes on to say, there will be a whole series of initiatives connected to units in the east. There will also be investments in infrastructure. He declined to say how many additional troops or units would be involved. He goes on, obviously, this has a link with what is happening in Ukraine. This is part of the process of drawing conclusions from that crisis. And it reminds us here that after the crisis in Ukraine broke out, Poland's government asked its NATO allies to establish a permanent military presence on Polish soil to act as a deterrent to Russia. But they stopped short of meeting that demand, I would think so, because some members were wary of the cost and of the risk of antagonizing Russia. And you know, I think that's a bigger threat to Finland and Estonia and maybe even Latvia and Lithuania than there is to Poland, but that Poland is as usual. I'm being hard on Poland tonight, I know, but you know, as usual, they're thinking about themselves and they haven't offered any assistance to anybody else. Not that they're capable of it, I guess. So we'll see. I thought that was kind of indicative of the way the Poles do things. Now I'm going to move to a little bit about religion before I get into the actual history I want to talk about. And at the end of the program today, I hope to get to this material on the ethnic cleansing between Ukrainians and Poles in 1943 in Volhynia. I should have time for that. I guess I should say, and I really mean it, that if someone would like to call in and add something to what I'm saying, you're welcome to do so. And the number is 323-642-1206. Everywhere, when I read about Poland, the Poles are saying, or these pages are saying, from its beginnings, Poland has contributed substantially to the development of religious freedom. And I know that this is something that the Poles believe, and I see it repeated, you know, in many different kind of places. And so I know this is one of their things that they promote about themselves. But it's never anything that I ever thought of in connection with Poland, because all I've known about Poland is that it's almost 100% Roman Catholic, and everybody's a Catholic, and they think that's the only religion that anybody should have, and you know, they're very faithful to it. I don't get the religious freedom part, you know. But I'll read what was written on this Wikipedia page about Poland's religion, and says, since the country adopted Christianity in 966, it was also welcoming to other religions through a series of laws. Well, you know, first I say, boy, you know, how they write these things, and they do it everywhere, saying that the country adopted Christianity in 966. There wasn't a country in 966. There was possibly this one man, Mieszko, the first who got baptized by the Piast order, you know, in the Catholic faith. And then it went from there. So there was no country, but they write it that way. And they do it all the time. When they write about ancient history, or this isn't so ancient at all, but older times, they act like everything, you know, this whole people was already organized and they all called themselves Poles and it was called, there was no such thing. And it irritates me when I see that. Anyway, this is very interesting. The series of laws that were made Poland so welcoming to other religions, there's two that they name. The Statute of Kaliz, K-A-L-I-S-Z, and the other one is the Warsaw Confederation in 1573. The Statute of Kaliz, it was in 1264, and it was a general charter of Jewish liberties. That's what it was. It gave the general charter of Jewish liberties. It granted Jews unprecedented legal rights in Europe, including exclusive jurisdiction over Jewish matters to Jewish courts, and established a separate tribunal for other criminal matters involving Christians and Jews. The statute was ratified by subsequent Polish kings. See, it was whoever was the ruler in 1264, he passed that, and I think it was Władysław, one of the Władysławs. It was ratified subsequently by Casimir III in 1334, Casimir IV in 1453, and Sigismund I in 1539. So they all agreed with this, and here are abridged excerpts from it. Just short, but I've got a number of them here. Very interesting. I'm going to read them because I think it's worthwhile. And number one, should a Jew be taken to court, not only a Christian must testify against him, but also a Jew in order for the case to be considered valid. Meaning that a Christian can't testify against a Jew in court. Only a Jew can. And if a Christian could testify, if a Jew also is testifying to the same thing. So therefore, you don't need the Christian. Number two, if any Christian shall sue a Jew, asserting that he has some securities that have been pawned with him, and the Jew denies it, then if the Christian refuses to accept the simple word of the Jew, by taking oath, must be free of the Christian. That is, the Christian is not going to get anywhere in the court by accusing a Jew of whatever, some kind of theft or something. If the Jew denies it, the Christian has to accept it. Then they go on to number 10. There's like 43 of these things, but they're not all as pertinent as these ones. Number 10, as punishment for killing a Jew, a suitable punishment and confiscation of property is necessary. So if a Christian were to kill a Jew, he has to be suitably punished, and also his property will be confiscated, or some of it anyway. Now, number 11, for striking a Jew, the usual punishment in the country shall apply. So, you know, you're going to have the usual punishment if you strike a Jew. You're not going to get away with it because he's a Jew. Number 13, Jews shall not pay for the transport of their dead. Why that, you know, why these Jews got these privileges, who can say? But they were given to them. Number 17, any Jew may freely and securely walk or ride without any let or hindrance in our realm. So they shall pay customary tolls just as other Christians do, and nothing else. Okay. Number 22, if any of the Christians rashly and presumptuously jeers at their synagogues, such a Christian shall be required to pay and must pay to our Palatine, their guardian, 2 talents of pepper as punishment. So you better not sneer at a Jewish synagogue. 30, no Christian may summon any Jew into the ecclesiastical court in any way whatsoever, or for whatever property or summons he be summoned, nor shall the Jew make answer before the judge in the ecclesiastical court, but the Jew shall appear before his Palatine, appointed for that term. Palatine is obviously a person who's one of the Jewish justice people. He has to appear before his own Palatine or judge. And furthermore, the aforesaid Palatine, along with our governor for that term, shall be required to defend and protect that Jew. Along with our governor has to required to defend and protect that Jew and prohibit his responding to the summons of the ecclesiastical court. No Christian is to accuse a Jew of blood libel. All right, that's out. Number 36 is the last one. Jews are allowed to purchase any items as well as to touch bread and other food. I guess they didn't want Jews to touch some things, but now they can't stop that. And I just say, wow, that's really something. And they're so proud of it. I mean, they're publishing it, saying, oh, we have all this freedom of religion. And what do they point to? This freedom for the Jews. Now, I don't know. This was on a Wikipedia page, and I don't know why they pointed these out. I guess they thought that was showing how wonderfully kind and good the Polish people were, the Poles were to the Jews, as a positive thing. Of course, it's not positive to me and to most of my listeners. I don't know that this was only the Poles that did this, because I've heard of things like this in other countries too. But I will say, if it's not this statute of ends with an SZ, so it's a Polish spelling, I'll just say that this is what they're always bragging about their history of religious freedom, and I guess this is what they mean. Because the only other thing they mentioned, here I've got a little more to say here. This was on the same page. In the 1920s, Polish Jewish artist and activist Arthur Zyk, S-Z-Y-K, illuminated. He lived until 1951. He was born at the end of the 19th century. He illuminated the Statute of Cluj in a cycle of 45 watercolor and gouache miniature paintings. In addition to the original Latin, Zyk translated the text of the statute into Polish, Hebrew, Yiddish, Italian, German, English, and Spanish. In 1929, Zyk's statute miniatures were exhibited throughout Poland, namely in Lodz, Warsaw, Krakow, and Kalisz. With support from the Polish government, selections of the statute miniatures were exhibited in Geneva in 1931, once again in Poland as part of a 14-city tour in 1932, in London in 1933, and in Toronto in 1940, and in New York in 1941. And then, without government patronage, in New York in 1944, 1952, and 1974-75. In 1932, the statute, which is all of his paintings depicting it, was published by Editions de la Table Ronde de Paris as a collector's luxury limited edition of 500. His original miniatures are now in the holdings of the Jewish Museum in New York. Isn't that wonderful? They're so proud of all of this. Now, the Warsaw Confederation in 1573 was different. It was an important development in the history of Poland and Lithuania that extended religious tolerance to nobility and free persons within the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. Well, only the nobility, not the ordinary people, not the poor peasants. And this is considered the formal beginning of religious freedom in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, and in fact is the first such document in Europe. And while it did not prevent all conflict based on religion, it did make the Commonwealth a much safer and more tolerant place than most of the contemporaneous Europe, especially during the subsequent 30 Years' War. So they didn't allow in the upper echelons fights about passing laws or anything between Catholics and probably Protestants, but maybe it was largely between Roman Catholic and Greek Orthodox and Russian Orthodox, things like that. But anyway, it says the Polish king, Władysław II Jagiello, was pressed by the Catholic Church to issue the Edict of Wieland, outlawing early Protestant Hussitism. Well, this is a particular form of Protestantism, but in Poland they really didn't like Protestants, but it said that there were quite a few there during certain periods of time. Anyway, that's all I'm going to go over about religion. And I want to just real briefly mention culture and artists, because there's a real lack of that in Poland. They list a whole lot of artists of all different types, but, you know, they're people you never heard of except in Poland. So the only two major artistic greats, I would say, cultural greats that actually were born and grew up and were actual Polish people are Joseph Conrad, the novelist and writer, the author, and Frederick Chopin, the composer, mostly of piano pieces. But both of these people didn't live in Poland after they came of age. Joseph Conrad took on a sailing life, the life of, you know, of ships and so on. And when he finished with that, I think he was in his 30s or something, and he had already started writing some things. And he lived in England, and he wrote in English always, everything. And Frederick Chopin grew up in Poland, but he, when he came of age, he did some traveling, and then he lived in France for the rest of his life. And he spoke French. So Conrad spoke English and Chopin spoke French and preferred that. Then as far as painters go, most important Polish painters are named Jan Matejo and Stanisław Witkiewicz. And they're very famous in Poland, and they painted these big historic type paintings in Polish history, and quite talented and, you know, perfectly good painters, but they're really not known otherwise unless you're real. Well, you know, I studied art history in school, and I don't remember any Polish painters being ever brought up, like, you know, painters like this. In any case, and then there's no Polish architecture. There's I couldn't find a single, and under architecture, they didn't list a single Polish architect. They just talked about the architecture in Poland in the various cities, which mostly was German, you know, described it and all that as, you know, being what you would see in Poland. Like it was Polish, but it wasn't created by Poles, and they don't seem to have any. They don't seem to be the kind of people that can become architects. You know, that's very advanced kind of thinking, architecture. But in any event, that's all I'm going to say about that. It's just, it's noticeable that they're not there, although the Poles make a big effort to say, oh, we have this rich cultural life, and they start naming all these people. But one thing they didn't name was a single architect of any modern variety or even an old one. So now I'm going to look at the history of the Poles. I'll just read a few things I have down here that give some information. Historians have postulated that throughout late antiquity, the 3rd to the 7th century, considered late antiquity. And remember, Poland supposedly began in the 9th century. No, it would be the 10th century. And many distinct ethnic groups populated the regions of what is now called Poland. The ethnicity and linguistic affiliation of these groups have been hotly debated. The time and route of the original settlement of Slavic peoples in these regions lacks written records and can only be defined as fragmented. And, you know, basically, there is no record of what took place there, and there is a lot of different peoples. They say many distinct ethnic groups populated this region, and who they were and is hotly debated. It's not agreed upon at all. And we don't know really where they came from and exactly what their route was or anything. So it's unknown. And the most famous archaeological find from the prehistory and proto-history of Poland is the Biskupin fortified settlement. It's now reconstructed as an open-air museum. Dates from 700 BC. 700 BC, this settlement that has been discovered in this area, I guess, where Poland is, It dates from the Lusatian culture of the early Iron Age. It, from what I could, what I read about it, and there is a page on it, and I read that, it's more pre-Germanic than anything else. That's what they say most of the time about the Lusatian culture, pre-Germanic. But this page goes on to say, History of the Poles page, the Slavic groups who would form Poland migrated to these areas in the second half of the 5th century A.D. Well, now we're talking about 700 B.C., and now they jump to 400 A.D., that's over 1,000 years later, and try to make a connection or something. I don't know. There's no, you know, there's no connection there. Anyway, they just say the main religion was paganism, and the transition to Christianity was not a smooth and instantaneous process for the rest of the population, as is evident from the pagan reaction of the 1030s. So, you know, the story of Misko the First that I told about and read about last week, as though it was like, well, he got baptized in 966 or something. He was actually from, supposedly from Norway, but they never say that. They just say he emigrated into the area. He's shown with very black hair and a big black beard. And he emigrated there, and he got in with the Piast order, and they baptized him, and then, you know, he formed Poland. He formed Catholic Poland, something like that, you know, just like that. Didn't work that way. It was just him. I'll have more about that in a minute. A little thing here about the Pale of Settlement, you know, the place where the Russians put all the Jews for a while. Well, in March 1917, the Pale was abolished by the Provisional Government Decree. That was the Bolsheviks, and on abolition of confessional and national restrictions. I'm not sure what that's supposed to mean now. But a large portion of the Pale, together with its Jewish population, became part of Poland. So I was just thought that was a little bit interesting there, that here's this, all this place where all the Jews lived, and they made it part of Poland, at least a large portion of it. So Poland just kept getting the Jews. Now, here's a paragraph from Wikipedia. See, I'm blaming Wikipedia for this information. The Kingdom of Poland, it says. Yeah, Kingdom of Poland. Was the Polish state from the coronation of the first king, Boleslaw I, the Brave, in 1025, to the union with Lithuania and the rule of the Jagiellon dynasty in 1385. Well, what I basically think about this scene is that right, they're talking about the Kingdom of Poland from the first king, Boleslaw the First, which goes way back. And there was no, I just don't believe there was a Kingdom of Poland at that time. I think there's, and I start to think that there's no such thing as a Pole, really. There's no such thing as Polish people, which really has any particular beginning to it. Somehow, in all this misty time that there's no facts, no references, no sources about it, no history to it, it seems, nobody's found the connections. No historians have found the connections to connect it, except some Polish historians who are famous for going along with the deal there and kind of invent things and write about it in a storybook way, but there's no facts there either. I ask, who crowned Boleslaw? He's the first king. Who crowned him? And I don't think he was a king. He was king of what territory? King of what? They say there's king of Poland. What does that mean at this time? I already talked about Duke Misko the First. I read a bunch of pages on Wikipedia about this early history, and in all of them, there's no source. There's no references. There's nothing to show where it comes from. It's just a little story. So, you know, there was really no Poland there. I don't know when Poland got the name Poland. I haven't been able to find that. So now listen to this. I say, yeah, C-R-A-P. Listen to this stuff from the page at Wikipedia. The early dukes and kings of Poland regarded themselves as descendants of the semi-legendary Piast the Wheelwright, first mentioned in the Chronicae, Latin for Chronicles and Deeds of the Dukes or Princes of the Poles. So somebody made up this Chronicles and Deeds of the Dukes and Princes of the Poles, and the Dukes and Kings of Poland regarded themselves, or made it up, that they were the descendants of some kind of legendary beings. And this Chronicle and Deeds of the Dukes or Princes of the Poles was written in 1113 by Gallus Anonymous, an anonymous person. Of course, it probably was written a whole lot later than that, and then dated back. However, the term Piast dynasty was not applied until the 17th century. There's a couple of references for this. So the reason is that it was a Polish historian, Adam Naruszewicz, introduced this idea in a historical work of his. The expression Piast dynasty. It existed before that, and it is not documented in contemporary sources. They make these things up, and they make fancy names for them, like dynasty and so on, when they were no such thing. So nobody called it that until this Polish guy did in the 1700s, and no, 17th century, 1600s. But they've got, there's a page at Wikipedia that titled List of Polish Monarchs. It's really interesting. I found it one of the most interesting. And if you go there, just List of Polish Monarchs at Wiki, it starts out with the legendary rulers. Poland in the early Middle Ages. Well, there was no Poland, but they want to think that they want to say there was. They want to call it that. And their first ruler was Lech I, L-E-C-H, you know, Lech I in the 6th century. He was the legendary founder of the Polish nation. And they have a drawing there, a little tiny one of some scene in black and white that's supposed to represent Lech. And then the second one came in the 8th century, Krakus, K-R-A-K-U-S, the first. Krakus was the legendary founder of Krakow. And they've got there's a drawing of a man in, you know, very old like clothing of the type then, looking like a Slavic type maybe clothing. And then after him, in the 8th century, came Krakus II, his son, and he was also legendary. They don't have any drawing of him. Somebody could make a drawing, because these are just drawings that anyone can make and say, here it is, because they don't look like anybody. They're black and white line drawings. And then we have Lech II in the 8th century, too, legendary son of Krakus and successor of Krakus II. And he's standing there with the big sword. And then we have Wanda. Now, I think Wanda is really interesting. They brought a woman in. She's the legendary daughter of Krakus, also in the 8th century. And there's pages for these people. I didn't have time to look at their pages. I didn't even, until today, I looked at Wanda's page and I started reading it. It's pretty interesting, but I didn't finish it. But she's just a fictional, you know, these are just fictional characters. And one thing we know for sure about the Polish, the Poles, is that, as has been stated by Adolf Hitler, that they are big on imagination. And very poor in, what was the thing that the Czechs have? The Czechs are very realistic and, not very imaginative, but good at figuring out what to do and how to do things and so on. But the Poles have too much imagination and not enough anything else. And so they create these legendary characters for them going way back in history, and the Poles just probably love it, you know, and they believe it, and they continue to paint paintings of these characters, and they continue to name things after them and so on, and believe in them. Kind of like believing in, it's kind of like the Virgin Mary, who nobody's ever seen. Nobody knows what she looks like, but they paint pictures of her all the time and, you know, make her look real sweet and so on. And that's what they do here. And then after these legendary rulers, they have the semi-legendary rulers. And there's five of these. Before we get to the Piast dynasty, who are also supposed to be dukes of the Poland. So these semi-legendary rulers are Leszko I, and there's a strange line drawing of something there to represent him. And then there's Leszko II. He comes after him, and he looks more like a person in this drawing. Well, they all have crowns on their heads. And then Leszko III, who was a duke. These were all dukes, not kings, and there's a picture of him. And then Popiel I, who was another duke. Then Popiel II is another duke, who were these semi-legendary rulers of the western Polands, of greater Poland. And then we have the Piast dynasty, dukes of the Polands, and starts with Chosisko. There's no picture of him. And then Piast the wheelwright. He's the most famous and the one that they mention most often. He's in the 9th century, a legendary ruler of the Polands, son of Chosisko, the one I just mentioned, father of Siemowit, founder of the Piast dynasty. There was no Piast dynasty. There was no Piast the wheelwright. But there's a drawing there of somebody, and he's got a certain image that they show to represent him. He's the main one that's brought up that is like the father of the Polish nation or something. Before Mieszko I was baptized a Catholic and started things out. But before that, he kind of represents something. And then after him, his son, Siemowit, and then Siemowit's son, Lestek, and Lestek's son, Siemomizel. And they all have these drawings of them, you know, black and white drawings that anybody could be produced. It could be anybody. Then we come, I'm telling you, this thing goes on. Then we have Mieszko I of Poland. Sometimes they call him the king, but now he's relegated to just being a duke because they never can't show that he's a king. But he supposedly lived from 940 to 992, and his reign started in 960. What reign? He didn't have a reign. But anyway, he's the son of the last one I just mentioned. He's the first Christian, the first historically documented ruler. And after him comes Boleslaw I, the Brave, and then Mieszko II, Lambert, and it goes on. There's a whole bunch of them, And they're represented by these little pictures. And now they're color paintings. They're like illustrations, mostly of their faces and, you know, bust-like thing, or sometimes goes down a little further. And like, if you click on the picture, you can see it a little bit bigger. And it's just, you know, anybody could have painted it. Who knows what he looked like? Of course, nobody knows, but they've got him pictured here with a lot of black, very black hair. He's very black, dark eyes. He's got a big black beard and long black hair and a very elegant, fancy costume on, and always holding a cross in one hand and a sword in the other. And they're all painted by the same person. You can tell. I mean, I can certainly tell that. They're all painted by the same person, most of them, as you go along, up until you get to, well, once in a while they don't have a painting of them, so they just have something, either nothing or a drawing of some kind, which is not them either. But they all have black hair, and I'm thinking, what the heck? What happened? How do these Poles get to be so blonde and blue-eyed? Like, these people look, these early ones look like they're Greeks or Italians, Romans, or even Jews, some of them. So, but until you get to Boleslaw III, he has red hair. And then there's some more light-haired ones coming up. And there's just every kind. And somebody's done a painting of every one of them in the same style, exactly the same style. And why this is all on Wikipedia, I don't know. But the Poles put it there. The Polish people must have put it there. They have all this. Maybe this is part of this chronicle that was taken around. But we come up to 1500s, 1600s. But these early ones that I've said, I doubt that they existed, or maybe somebody existed, but it's very much like mythology. You don't know if what's said about it is anything like the way they were. Okay, this Piast dynasty, introduced by the Polish historian Adam Naruszewicz, says it's not documented in contemporary sources, but there's a footnote, 3, an encyclopedia, Polish Encyclopedia, Warsaw, 1975, that mentions him. And then a footnote 4 in the Encyclopedia Britannica, retrieved in 2011, mentions the Piast dynasty. And it says about it, the name Piast was not applied to the dynasty until the 17th century. See, and that refers to this Polish historian, Naruszewicz, who did that. And this is what these Polish historians do. This is what Elsa Loser was telling us about on the things that she wrote, that they've created all this. It doesn't fit real history. Now, for some people, they don't care about real history. What difference does it make? Give the Polish people a history and they want to have a history. Well, you know, they've used their history to claim things that they don't have a claim to. And they've claim that they have all this long history and all these lands, and they've been the owners of areas, or you know, they ruled over areas, and they deserve to have this or that or the other thing. But this is where they're behaving, in my opinion, like Jews. But be that as it may, let me go back to my studio here. I'm gonna go ahead and play Heinrich Schleusenus. It's 3 minutes and 50 seconds, ladies and gentlemen. So we're going to have almost a 4-minute break here while you listen to Heinrich, his very fine singing.
Ja, du weißt es, teure Seele, von Richard Strauss. Und wer in die Fremde will wandern, Wolf, mit Heinrich Schleusenus. Unfreiwilliger Abgesang auf eine Welt, von der nur die Trümmer übrig blieben.
Die Sterne, die schienen wie ich ging zu ihr. gar nicht so gerne. Sie sang vor der liebsten Tür. Der Morgen, das ist meine Freude, das steig ich in stillen Stund auf den höchsten Berg in die Weite. Grüß dich Deutschland aus Herzen
Brand. We are back now. That didn't take very long. I was looking for the information about what he was singing. It was, you know, I do have something here by Chopin. That would have been the right thing to do, but I didn't. So, because we talked, Chopin was Polish. What you just heard, it's a Wolf Lied, 1944. Wolf Lied, 1944 is all I can find. That's what we were listening to, and it was Strauss music. And he was singing one of the, something that was put to music by Richard Strauss, I do believe. Now, back to business here. Okay, I went to another page for Polans. There's a page for the Polans, P-O-L-A-N-S. This is called Western Polans. And it does say at the beginning that this article on the Polans does not cite any references or sources. So it's another one of those where they tell the story they want to tell about who the Polans were, but we don't know, it doesn't come from anywhere. And it says that the name was derived from Old Slavic pole, field, or plain. Pole meant field or plain. They were a West Slavic tribe, part of the Lekitic, that would be that Lek. Remember that legendary ruler, the very first one, Lek I? Well, now they're trying to connect these people with Lek and call it the Lekitic group. They inhabited the Vorta River basin in the historic Greater Poland region in the 8th century. Yeah, that would be the 700. See, that's just an unverified concept that's just made up. That's what it is. And if anybody can prove to me that it's not, you go ahead. But even on Wikipedia, they're not able to do that. They just write about it, and people read stuff there and think that it tells them what's what. So I'm going to now, there's a little bit here about Volhynia. Volhynia, I'm going to be talking about that later. And I thought whether I should save this for then or read it now, but it has to do a lot with the present time. Well, or does it? I'll just go through it. This is the history of Volhynia, V-O-L-H-Y-N-I-A, and it's that area that between Poland and Ukraine, which Poles and Ukrainians were fighting over and competing in this area for a long time, but in the 1943, it became the center of a lot of ethnic cleansing. So it says here, the ancient city of Halych first appears in history in 981, when it's taken over by Vladimir the Great of the Kievan Rus. So the Kievan Rus were supposed to be Swedes and like Vikings, but our Viking types, they weren't necessarily Vikings. I think that Viking business is overdone, I do believe. But Volhynia's early history coincides with that of the duchies or principalities of Halych and Volhynia. These two successor states of the Kievan Rus formed Halych, Volhynia, between the 12th and the 14th centuries. Okay. After the disintegration of the Halych Volhynia, also called Galich Vladimir Rus, about 1340, the Kingdom of Poland and the Grand Duchy of Lithuania divided up the region between them, Poland taking the Western Volhynia and Lithuania Eastern Volhynia. After 1569, this seemed to work for a while, from 1352 to 1569. But after that, Volhynia formed a province of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. The Duchy of Lithuania was one thing. Later, they formed the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. During this period, Poles and Jews settled in the area. Volhynia was mostly Ukrainian. The Poles moved into the area, and Jews in 1569 after that, during this period, and the Roman and Greek Catholic churches became established in the province because before it was just Orthodox, probably Russian, because basically Ukrainians were considered to be Russia, but, you know, they seem to always think of themselves as Ukrainians. You know, they seem to have this identity of themselves as separate from Russia. After the Roman and Greek Catholic churches established themselves here, because the Poles came, then many Orthodox churches joined the latter, that is, the Greek Catholic Church. Some of the Orthodox churches joined the Greek Catholic Church so as to benefit from a more attractive legal status. Records of the first agricultural colonies of Mennonites date from 1783 around here, around this area, I guess. And after the third partition of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth in 1795, Volhynia became the Volhynian Governorate of the Russian Empire and covered an area of almost 72,000 square kilometers. This annexation changed greatly the religious makeup of the area, as the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church was forcibly liquidated by the Russian government, the ownership of all its building being transferred to the Russian Orthodox Church. Many Roman Catholic Church buildings were also given to the Russian Church, and the Roman Catholic Diocese of Lutsk was suppressed on orders of Empress Catherine II. You know, I know why I copied that out and had it here, because I found it there on Wikipedia, and it relates to what I'm going to be talking about after I finish with Poland here. I should have probably waited, so I hope you can remember kind of what I read there. It's for later. Anyway, now we're going to go to the best known Polish leader, and that is Jagiello. He was known as Jogaila, J-O-G-A-I-L-A, and later they changed it to Polonized it to Jagiello with two L's and an E in it. Anyway, he supposedly was born on the 1st of June, 1434. You know, a lot of these people, they have them born on the first day of the month, of a month. I think they just decide that's the right thing for an important person. And he was supposedly the Grand Duke of Lithuania from 1377 to 1434, and is called the last pagan ruler of the medieval Lithuania. He was born pagan. But see, little is known of his early life, and even his year of birth is not certain. He was a descendant of the Gediminid dynasty and was probably born in Vilnius. Well, he was Lithuanian. That's the deal. And the Grand Duchy of Lithuania, you know, Pilsudski was Lithuanian too. But his family was very Polonized. There are a lot of important Poles who were not genetically Polish. They were something else, but they were very Polonized and identified as Poles. Well, this Grand Duchy of Lithuania was a political entity composed of two leading but very different nationalities and two political systems, ethnic Lithuania, who are not Slavs, they're not Slavic, in the northwest, and the vast Ruthenian territories of former Kievan Rus in the south, comprised, that would be Ukraine and other stuff, comprising the lands of modern Ukraine, Belarus, and parts of Western Russia. And they are Slavs. So you have the non-Slavs in Lithuania and the Slavs on the other part. At first, Jogaila, like his father, based his rule in the southern and eastern territories of Lithuania, while his uncle, Kęstutis, the Duke of Trakai, continued to rule the northwestern region. you know, in between these two countries, these two entities, Poland was the smaller one and was to the west of Lithuania. And I don't quite always understand the directions that they're giving and why they are the way they say. But anyway, unrest in the Rus lands, that's the southern part, the Slavic part, and challenge to his authority, challenge to Jagiello's authority, ended up with two of his brothers siding against him. And he was, Jagiello was allied with the Emir Mamai, a de facto Khan of the Golden Horde, which were Muslims. And they tended to do that to get, you know, some strength on their side. He was also, sometimes his competitor was allied with this Golden Horde, but at this point he was allied with them against his brothers. But in 1380, Muscovy was weakened, and Jagiello was free to begin a struggle with Lithuanian leader Kęstutis for supremacy. Now, Kęstutis was his uncle. And so there you have this family, you know, fighting for who gets the throne. And Jagiello secretly concluded the Treaty of Dowidziszkie directed against Kęstutis. He secretly concluded a treaty with some other people. And when Kęstutis discovered the plan, the Lithuanian civil war began between them. And Kęstutis seized Vilnius, overthrew Jagiello, and pronounced himself Grand Duke in his place. In 1382, Jagiello raised an army from his father's vassals and confronted Kęstutis near Trakai. Kęstutis and his son Vytautas, now this Vytautas plays a big role and continues to for a long time. Kęstutis and his son Vytautas, which would have been Jagiello's cousin, entered Jagiello's encampment for negotiations, but they were tricked and imprisoned in the Kreva Castle, where Kęstutis was found dead, probably murdered a week later. However, his son Vytautas escaped to the Teutonic fortress of Marienburg and was baptized there under the name of Wiegand. So he became a Catholic. Now, this should, you know, I found this real interesting because right in the beginning they're fighting for the who gets to be the boss or the Grand Duke or whatever, and the one who wins, Jagiello, did it through tricking his uncle and cousin by pretending that he wanted to have some negotiation with them after forming this treaty with whoever, and calls them in, and they trust him for some reason. They probably didn't think he was going to do this. When they come to his encampment, probably had some guards with them, but still, they were arrested. They were taken and imprisoned, and the uncle was killed. So that's how you do it, you know, in those days. That's how these great leaders got to be the great leaders they were. And but Vytautas got away. And Jagiello prepared a treaty to reward the knights for helping him destroy Vytautas by promising to Christianize his people and give the knights some land west of the Dubiza River. Well, he asked the knights to help him to do this, and he was going to reward them if they would do this and give them some land. But I don't know that the knights did do that because Vytautas continues on. So after he became king of Poland, as a result of the Union of Krewo, the newly formed Polish-Lithuanian Union confronted the growing power of the Teutonic Knights. When the treaty that Jagiello wanted the Knights to ratify, when that didn't happen, when he failed in that endeavor of his, the Knights invaded Lithuania in the summer of 1383. And in 1384, Jagiello reconciled with this cousin Vytautas, promising to return his patrimony in Trakai. So you see, you're only strong when you have things going your way, and when not, then you have to do some negotiating. But Vytautas bought into that, and he turned against the knights and attacked and looted several Prussian castles. And I just think, you know, what a bunch of sneaky, untrustworthy people. That's that story, which is not over yet. But in the meantime, Jagiello gets married, and it's to help his power base. He had a Russian mother Uliana up there. And you know this Yogyalo is the founder of the famous Jagiellonian University that is so well known and that lasted so long. And I've talked about that with Andreas Besserle. He talked about that. And you can read a lot about that. Anyway, that's where that comes from. But it doesn't come into what I'm talking about today. So I thought I'd just remind you, though. So Yogyalo's mother was Russian, and she wanted him to marry Sophia, who was the daughter of Prince Dmitry of Moscow. But in order to do that, he had to first convert to Orthodoxy. If he did that, it wouldn't halt the Crusades against Lithuania by the Teutonic Knights. He was trying to make deals with the Teutonic Knights and not have them be fighting against him. He, instead of doing what his mother wanted, the Knights didn't like the Orthodox. They liked only the Roman Christians, and so they considered the others heathen. So Yogyalo therefore chose to accept a Polish proposal, it says, to become a Catholic. Yeah, okay, he was a Lithuanian, and he wasn't had anything to do with the Kingdom of Poland that was there, that little kingdom. But, it was all one big group now, I guess. But let's see, did we make that change already, put those two things together? Anyway, the Poles were different people. So he married a Catholic girl who was supposedly from the Polish, from the Kingdom of Poland, and she was 11 years old, 11-year-old Queen Jadwiga of Poland. And her name was actually Hedwig, which is a German name. And she was the daughter of King Louis I of Hungary and Elizabeth of Bosnia, so it says. Now, there may be a lot of mythology about her, but they seem to think that they've got all this history. Again, I don't see too many sources for it, but born in 1374, she became Queen of Poland when she was 10, between 10 and 11, and she gave birth to a child by Jagiello when she was 25, and she died, and the child died too, died in childbirth, after they married and so on. On her page, well, they've got these pictures, paintings of her, which you know they're not her. They're just, you know, glorified images of a beautiful young woman. And then the story written about her is all from this Norman Davies that I told you about in an earlier program. I would have liked to have talked more about him. It's kind of came back to me that he married a Polish woman, and then he started writing pro-Polish stuff, and he ended up writing all this stuff for Poland and histories and so on. But he started out as a journalist. He wasn't really a trained historian, but he wrote all this history-like material and books, and he invented a lot. He would say anything to make the Poles look good, you know, anything. He wrote about people involved in the Holocaust, too. And so I'm saying, you know, I don't know about this story about Jadwiga, but the Poles love it, you know, and they, you know, even though this Jagiello, after she died, he married three more times and finally had a couple of sons, but they think of her as the queen and him as the king, you know, they don't, that, because they're, the romantic nature of all of that is so strong. Let's see, I'm going to read about this. Norman Davies says that she grew up in the royal court of Hungary. She was highly educated. She spoke five languages. Well, she was only 10 or 11 years old when she got married. Here's what it says on her page. Yogyalo was duly baptized at the Wawel Cathedral in Krakow on 15th February 1386. And from then on, formally used the name Władysław, or Latin versions of it. So he became a Catholic in order to get along with the Teutonic Knights, and he married this Catholic girl. And the marriage took place 3 days after his baptism. He was crowned King Władysław by the Archbishop Bozanta at that time. He was also to be legally adopted by Jadwiga's mother, Elizabeth of Bosnia, so retaining the throne in the event of Jadwiga's death. That idea was that he was then part of that family also, because the mother adopted him. So because Jadwiga had an actual, because of her parents, she was the heir to the throne of the Polish kingdom. And by her mother adopting her new husband, he also then was an heir to that throne. And this was the reason that it was done, so that if Jadwiga died, they wouldn't say, well, you don't have any right to be on our throne, and kick him out. And the royal baptism triggered the conversion of most of Jogaila's court and noblemen. That's who became Catholic, not the people. And then it says there were mass baptisms in Lithuanian rivers, a beginning of the final Christianization of Lithuania. But it says that both paganism and orthodoxy remained strong among the peasants. So Jagiello's baptism failed to end the crusade of the Teutonic Knights. After all, they didn't think that much of it, I guess. So they claimed that his conversion was a sham. Yeah, they didn't think he really meant it. Perhaps even a heresy. And they renewed their incursions on the pretext that pagans remained in Lithuania. They wanted to get rid of all the pagans. In 1389, Vladislav's rule in Lithuania faced a revived challenge from Vytautas, who was still around and resented the power given to Skirgaila in Lithuania at the expense of his own patrimony. So he started a civil war in Lithuania, aiming to become the Grand Duke. He joined forces with the Teutonic Grand Master, Conrad. So these people were always, making different little alliances and secretly and so on. And then this bloody conflict was eventually brought to a temporary halt in 1392 with the Treaty of Ostrau, when Władysław handed over the government of Lithuania to his cousin in exchange for peace. Vytautas was to rule Lithuania as a Grand Duke until his death. Yeah, the new Władysław, who was Jagiello, he was called Władysław Jagiello, made peace with his cousin. For that reason, he became King of Poland. This, again, goes back to Jadwiga giving birth to a daughter. She baptized Elizabeth Bonifacia, but within a month they had both died. Then that caused, even in spite of him being adopted by his mother-in-law, I guess, that caused the nobles, certain people, to question his right to the throne. And so then he married someone named Selja, a granddaughter of Casimir III of Poland, and a political match which re-legitimized his reign. Then there was another war with the Teutonic Order, which ended in 1404. Well, they had a big war, and after crossing the Vistula over the pontoon bridge at Cervinski, his troops joined with those of Vytautas. Here's where they got the better of the Teutonic Order. The things were quiet for a while, and then Jagiello joined up with his cousin Vytautas once again, and they went after the Teutonic Order. They weren't prepared for it, but these others two were. And between them, they had, this is 1410, they had an army of about 20,000 mounted nobles, 15,000 armed commoners, 2,000 professional cavalry, mainly hired from Bohemia. And then after he crossed the Vistula, he met with the troops of Vytautas, who had 11,000 light cavalry, the Teutonic Order had only about 18,000 cavalry, mostly Germans, and 5,000 infantry. So they were outnumbered, and they were also surprised. And on that was the Battle of Grunewald, which is so famous, in which the Poles declare as their great victory at the Battle of Grunewald, when they defeated the Germans, and it sort of stands out, I don't know, as something even more than it should be, because it's the only big victory they had, I guess. So they really defeated the Teutonic Order there, which was virtually annihilated, and most of its key commanders were killed in combat, including, a couple of famous ones. Thousands of troops were reported to have been slaughtered on either side. And the road to the Teutonic capital, Marienburg, now lay open to them, to Jagiello, Władysław Jagiello and his cousin. And the city was undefended. But for reasons the sources do not explain, Władysław hesitated to pursue his advantage. On 17th July, his army began a labored advance, arriving at Marienburg only on the 25th of July. Very slow. They were very slow to get there. By which time, the Grand Master, Heinrich von Plauen, had organized a defense of the fortress. The apparent half-heartedness of the ensuing siege, which was called off by Władysław Jagiello on 19th September, has been ascribed variously to the impregnability of the fortifications, to high casualty figures among the Lithuanians, to Vladislav's unwillingness to risk further casualties, or to his desire to keep the order weakened but undefeated as to not upset the balance of power between Poland, which would most likely acquire most of the order possessions if it was totally defeated, and Lithuania, that is, the balance of power between Poland and Lithuania. But a lack of sources precludes a definitive explanation. So that's one of the mysteries, but seems like they could have had a much bigger victory than they did, or made more of their victory than they did. So it all ended with the Peace of Thorn, which is well known, and which neither Poland nor Lithuania drove home their negotiating advantage to the full in the peace process either, much to the discontent of the Polish nobles. Most of the Teutonic Order's territory, however, including towns which had surrendered, remained intact. Władysław then proceeded to release many high-ranking Teutonic knights and officials for apparently modest ransoms. The cumulative expense of the ransoms, however, did prove a drain on the order's resources. But the failure to exploit the victory to his noble satisfaction provoked growing opposition to Władysław's regime after 1411, further fueled by the granting of Podolia, a disputed territory between Poland and Lithuania, or a town or something. He granted that to Vytautas, and he was also absent for 2 years from Lithuania, Władysław was. He started hanging out in the Polish part. And that's how he kind of went from being a Lithuanian to a Pole and being the hero of the Poles. The Treaty of Mino has been seen as a turning point. This treaty of turning a Polish victory into defeat as a result of Władysław's renunciation of Polish claims to Pomerania, Pomerelia, and Kielmoland, which he received only the town of Niezawa in return for his victory, and this Treaty of Mino closed a chapter in the Knights' Wars with Lithuania, but did little to settle their long-term issues with Poland. Further sporadic warfare broke out between Poland and the Knights between 1431 and 1435. So they never really got the victory over that northern part, which is under the control of the Teutonic Knights. Is it kind of a tendency of the Poles to somehow not win, or not, even if they have a big victory? And in a lot of ways they get a victory. Sometimes they get things. Like, look what they gained after World War I in their Polish Republic. And they screwed it up and just ruined it. And everybody hated them. And they weren't respected either by the British for what they were doing there. And I read all about that last week. And now, after World War II, they've got their big country. And they're not making a success of it. Not really. They're doing as good as most countries over there do, I guess, but in the East. But it's kind of, you know, all the Polish people are leaving to go find a better situation somewhere else in the West. So now this is, I'm going to sum up the program, this part of the program, and I may not be able to really get into the other part. I'm going to sum it up in a couple of ways. First, I'm going to say, why does the world feel sorry for the Poles and try to give them a hand? I mean, that's how I see it, that no matter what, no matter how unhelpful the Poles are, they seem to get a lot of sympathy. They get a lot of sympathy all the time. You know, is it because, and this is going to sound very harsh, but I don't know how else to say it, is it because they're so pathetic, or they can appear so pathetic, that, you know, like I was just saying about some of their victories and the way they handle things, and they just can't seem to make a success of things, even though they have a lot of opportunity? They do for a while, but then it eludes them. And this helplessness, like in this in the news article I read in the beginning, of they want the NATO to come and defend them from the Russians if necessary. And of course, that's what NATO is for. But NATO's got a whole lot to defend there and to do if necessary. But they're just calling on that. They're not really too concerned with anybody but themselves, and that's so typical of the Polish. And I think that for all their helplessness, where they need help, they want help, they want favors and so on, they are still a dangerous element in European history. They have been. They've been behind a whole lot of things. They're not maybe powerful enough to do super-duper damage, but they've been damaging in their underhanded methods that they use. So now I want to say that the Hitler regime, for me, this is my opinion, the Hitler regime represented the gold standard of European success. The reason we're sinking into oblivion as the white European people all around the world is precisely, I think, because we've opposed ourselves to this highest standard of European success, which was represented by Hitler and his National Socialist Third Reich. And in my opinion, the only salvation for Europe and Europeans around the world is Hitlerism, which is in fact being condemned all the time as the worst thing for Europe, the worst thing that ever happened to Europe and Europeans. But the reason that I say this is because the problem being the Jew, large part being the Jews, the Jewish control of all of Europe, was what only Hitler was trying to get rid of. Nobody else tries to get rid of it. They might be a little bit anti-Jewish, but they're not going to actually do anything about it. When it came down to having their Jews removed, they all started grabbing hold and embracing them. You know, oh, no, we can't do that, you know. There's something wrong with most of these peoples, when it comes to the Jews. And of course, the Germans are far from it now, but maybe it could be brought back under the right conditions. And that this is why I think that we need to look to our very best people and not look to saying, well, we're all going to contribute to this, and then we'll succeed. Because a lot of peoples don't contribute to it, never have contributed to it. Well, I have a lot on that in this upcoming part about the Ukrainian-Polish ethnic cleansings in 1943, and that's involved Germany a lot, and German occupation and so on. So there's a lot that fits in with that, in that, but I don't think I'm going to be able to get very far with it. I'm just going to have to give a quick overview because I don't think I feel up to going on overtime tonight. And I'll say finish off by saying here that our governments are European governments are anti-European people and anti-white, anti-strong. We all know that. And German government is no different. And this is what has to be turned around. And it has to be done with the philosophy of strength, not worrying about everybody's feelings, not worrying about, you know, oh, well, we can't say one group is better than another. They're better because they're stronger, they're smarter, And they've got the will to do things that these others never showed that they had. So that's where I'm coming from on this. You know, we don't need the Mother Teresa stuff. Oh, let's do a pity party on this group or on that group. They need some help. Oh, we need to build up their ego. We need to make them feel better. We don't need to do that. We need to find the strongest and the best, and then we need to set that up and follow that. I don't know how that would be done, but in my opinion, I have to say it, that that's the only thing that's going to work. That's the only thing that's going to work. And so much of what people are talking about today is just, it's just not going to go anywhere, and it's going to be too late. You know, it's just not going to happen. Nothing's going to happen soon enough. What can I say? That when the Germans invaded the Soviet Union in June 1941, it has been said that they should have brought the Slavic peoples, particularly the Ukrainians, on their side to fight with them. Well, they did bring the Ukrainians on their side. They were very busy doing that. It was mostly the Ukrainians that they got to work for them. But what we're dealing with here is Ukrainian nationalists. And this story, which is something written by Timothy Snyder in 2003, which is, I don't like Timothy Snyder at all. He's the author of that book, Killing Fields, where he writes about the Russian area, Ukraine and Russia, where the Germans were supposedly killing all these Jews, you know, as part of the Holocaust. And he's very pro-Holocaust, pro-Jew and all that stuff. But he's got some good research here anyway about the Ukrainian nationalists and the Polish nationalists and how they fought one another in this area called Bohemia, which was mostly Ukrainian and partly Polish. And it said that the population between the two was 5-1 in favor of Ukrainians. So it was mostly Ukrainians, but a lot of Poles there too. And the Ukrainians were the nationalists, the Bandera Ukrainians. There was another group too. And they were interested in creating a strictly Ukrainian nationalist state. And they were very active in that part, and they wanted to get rid of the Poles. They wanted to get all the Poles out of there. And the Poles were fighting to stay there for some reason. And the Ukrainians were working for the Germans, but they weren't loyal. If it worked out for them, they were pretty good. But in 1943, after the Battle of Stalingrad failed, and before that it was something else. But in 1943, that's when they saw that it was going to turn out differently, and they started to see the Soviet advance, and they started to change their mind, and they saw the Germans as just another group to get rid of, and they wanted to get rid of the Russians too, the communists. They didn't like them. Their whole thing was to become their own national group. That's all they cared about, all they saw. And the Poles got that way too. And the Poles were trying to save themselves. They didn't really have a country anymore, but they had some, you know, areas and territories and so on. And the slaughter that went on against these two people, with the Germans not doing it, the Germans used to try to prevent it to some degree, and they were trying to keep order in this area is what they were mostly doing. But there was no loyalty to the Germans, and in my opinion, there would not have been, no matter how the Germans treated them. They didn't treat them that badly. They were treated better than the Russians. They hated the Russians, but their only interest was really in themselves. And that's what I mean about this. Amongst the Slavic people, they basically don't really show a loyalty to a higher idea that you can find in Western Europeans to being against the Bolshevik threat to Europe and so on. They're always fighting just for their own independence. That's what they want. And they will go with whatever side, you know, as things change. And that's exactly what happened, not only with the Ukrainians, but with the Romanians who were fighting with the Germans and liked them. And the Hungarians who were fighting with the Germans. Of course, they're not Slavs, either one of those. But when things changed, they weren't going to get caught on the wrong side, and they tried to turn to the Russian side. Although when the Russians came in, they still treated them terrible and slaughtered them. So it didn't pay off, but it was only the Croatians, it seems to me, that really remained faithful allies to the National Socialists. But this is where, you know, I wanted to make the point with this whole story that Hitler made this huge mistake and would have won the war, would have conquered Russia if he had just asked these groups to fight with him and let them go and do what they wanted to do. They were all opposed to one another and, you know, had nationalist competitions going on between themselves. It wouldn't have worked out the way people seem to think. So I want to thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening tonight. And this is Carolyn Yeager with the Heretics Hour. And I will be back again next week. Thank you very much for listening.